Imagine like making a single bad stock recommendation and suddenly your client is threatening to bankrupt you.
Oh, yeah, it gets bad.
Right? Your boss is locking your files in some sort of radioactive vault, and FenRA investigators are at your door demanding to read through your personal text messages.
Which is literally everyone's worst nightmare in this industry.
Totally. Welcome to the financial industry's absolute nightmare scenario. Today, we are diving into exactly what happens when the wheels completely fall off the wagon. We are mastering complaints, disputes, and reporting. But before we get into it, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Check them out.
Yeah, if you're prepping for the Series 82, they have a full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. It's exactly what you need to pass. So check them out at certfuel.com.
It really is a lifesaver because this is the side of the business nobody wants to think about.
Right.
But it's the side you absolutely have to know to pass this exam. I mean, we
Yeah.
usually talk about the happy path where everyone makes money, but this is the unit that deals with the fallout.
Exactly. And I want to talk directly to you, the listener, right now. We know you are staring down the barrel of this exam. And we also know that reading pages and pages of FenRA regulations is, well, it's basically a prescribed cure for insomnia.
It's so dry.
It's terrible. So if your brain is the type that needs a little more kinetic energy to stay engaged, like if standard dry lectures just make your eyes glaze over, you are in the right place.
Because we are not doing a dry lecture today.
Yo, dry lectures. We promise you right now, we are bringing high energy, memorable chaos, and all the devious little traps you need to completely crush this unit.
And you need those traps because the exam isn't going to test you on some vague blended story.
No, they want the specifics.
Exactly. It tests you on very specific triggers, distinct clocks, and completely separate dollar thresholds. If you don't understand the underlying mechanics, like the actual why and how behind these rules, the test will catch you out.
It totally will.
Yeah.
So, to help us navigate this absolute nightmare of compliance, we've assembled a recurring cast of characters.
I love these guys.
They're the best. We're going to use them throughout this entire deep dive to map out exactly how things break down. So, first, we have Riley the Rep.
Good old Riley.
Yeah, Riley is a well-meaning but slightly chaotic registered representative. He's basically a walking magnet for compliance violations.
He really is. He uses his personal phone for things he definitely shouldn't.
Oh, absolutely. His desk looks like a recycling bin exploded, and he thinks attention to detail is like just a mild
The
suggestion.
compliance officer's worst nightmare, right there.
Right. And then sitting on the other side of the desk, we have Ingrid the investor.
Oh, Ingrid.
Ingrid is highly detail-oriented, easily annoyed, and keeps a meticulously color-coded binder of every single trade confirmation she has ever received.
She keeps the receipts, literally.
She is the client who will not hesitate to unleash absolute legal fury if she feels wronged.
So it's the immovable object meeting the incredibly disorganized force.
Precisely. And finally, trapped directly in the middle of this mess, we have Sam, the supervisor.
Poor Sam.
Yeah, Sam is the chronically stressed manager at the member firm. Sam's primary diet consists of antacids and stale break room coffee.
I'll say the antacids at this point.
Yeah, Sam is the one who has to clean up Riley's messes before FenRA shows up with a very large, very heavy book of sanctions.
It's such a volatile mix of personalities. And what's fascinating here is that every major regulatory disaster, it always starts with a single spark.
Right.
It doesn't usually start with a massive federal indictment. It starts with one disgruntled client deciding they've just had enough.
So let's light that fuse. Let's set the scene for the spark. It's a Tuesday afternoon. Ingrid the investor's portfolio just took a massive hit because some obscure corporate bonds that Riley recommended just absolutely
I
tanked.
don't know.
Yeah, the issuer missed an interest payment, the price plummeted, and Ingrid is livid. So she picks up her phone, calls Riley, and spends 45 solid minutes just screaming into the receiver.
Just a total meltdown.
Yeah, she is threatening to ruin his life, get him fired, sue the firm into oblivion, and like take his dog.
A very stressful Tuesday for Riley.
Incredibly stressful. Okay, so you listening right now, pause and think. I want you to really consider this. Ingrid is screaming on the phone, making explicit threats of legal action. Does this trigger FenRA's record-keeping rule for a customer complaint?
Give them a beat to think about it.
Yep, just think about it. Does it trigger the rule?
It does not.
Wait, really? Because she's literally threatening to sue him. How does that not count?
I know, it sounds crazy, but it doesn't matter how loud she screams, how severe her threats are, or how long she stays on the line. For the specific purposes of FINRA's written complaint records rule, the operative word is written.
Written?
Yes. An oral complaint, just by itself, does not create a record-keeping duty under this specific rule.
That feels like a massive loophole, though. Like, right. If I'm Sam the supervisor and I hear Riley getting yelled at for 45 minutes through the wall, I'd want that documented.
And internally, a good firm probably would document it, you know, for their own human resources or training purposes.
Right, just to cover their own bags.
Exactly. But we are talking about the strict regulatory requirement here. Think about the why behind the rule. Why does FINRA care so much about the medium?
Because words just disappear into the ether.
Precisely. A phone call is inherently he said, she said. If FINRA comes in to audit a firm 3 years later, they cannot audit a phone call from memory.
That makes sense.
Regulators need a physical, verifiable trail, paper, or, you know, a server log of an email. That is forever.
Okay, let me try out a slightly absurd analogy to make this stick for the listener.
Go for it.
Compare Ingrid's screaming phone call to a mysterious, terrible smell in the office break room.
Oh, boy.
Stay with me.
Yeah.
It's incredibly unpleasant. Riley definitely needs to deal with it. Sam, the supervisor, probably wants to know about it so they can fix whatever is rotting in the fridge.
Sure.
But FINRA Raleigh doesn't require Sam to, like, bottle up that smell and lock it in a filing cabinet for auditors to check later.
That's a bizarre visual, but yeah, it actually works perfectly. The smell is a problem, but it is an ephemeral problem.
Right. But the literal second Ingrid hangs up, realizes Riley isn't taking her seriously, and fires off a blistering 4-page email outlining exactly how terrible Riley is at his job. What happens then?
Then the smell solidifies.
Oh, gross.
Yeah, the moment it is in writing, it transforms into radioactive waste. It is now a formal, written customer complaint. And that triggers a very specific set of duties for Sam the supervisor. He must meticulously track it and store it.
Okay, so we have this radioactive email. Where does this radioactive waste have to be stored? Does Sam just, you know, keep it in his desk drawer?
No, definitely not. The rule states that each member firm must keep and preserve a separate file of all written customer complaints in each Office of Supervisory Jurisdiction, or OSJ.
Hold on, let's define OSJ for anyone whose eyes just glazed over at the jargon. Office of Supervisory Jurisdiction. What actually is that in plain English?
Think of it as a regional hub of authority for the broker-dealer.
Okay.
It's not just a small satellite branch where a couple of reps sit and make cold calls. An OSJ is a designated office where major supervisory activities happen.
Like what kind of activities?
Things like order execution, market making, structuring of public offerings, or where they maintain custody of customer funds. Crucially, it's where final approval of new accounts and advertising takes place.
Ah, so it's where the big decisions happen.
Exactly. And it's where a registered principal like Sam is physically located to review the activities of other branches.
Okay, so it's basically the manager's headquarters. But let me push back on the physical storage aspect of this. Let's say Sam works at an OSJ in Miami. Does Sam have to physically go to Home Depot, buy a heavy metal filing cabinet, bolt it to the floor inside the Miami office, and lock a printout of Ingrid's email in there?
Not necessarily, and this distinction is incredibly important for the exam.
Okay, lay it on us.
The duty to keep the records belongs to the firm, not the specific physical OSJ building itself. The OSJ is simply the designated location of jurisdiction.
So they don't need the physical filing cabinet.
Right, because FINRA Raleigh is actually somewhat modernized here. The firm can either keep the physical or electronic file right there at the OSJ, or they can maintain it elsewhere, like, say, a giant centralized compliance server in Omaha.
As long as they can get to it.
Exactly. As long as they can make the records promptly available at the OSJ upon FINRA's request.
Oh, okay. So if a FINRA auditor walks into the Miami OSJ and says, hey, show me the complaint file for Riley, Sam just needs to be able to instantly pull it up on his computer screen from the Omaha server.
Yep.
And if he can do that, they are totally compliant.
Exactly. The regulatory duty rests on the firm. The OSJ is just the required access point for the regulators.
That makes perfect sense. So how long does Sam have to keep this radioactive email from Ingrid? Like, how long is the retention period?
At least 4 years.
Okay, 4 years. Wait, I know there is a massive trap here. I can literally feel the test writers smiling from here.
You should feel them smiling because this is one of their absolute favorite tricks. Listen carefully to this, everyone.
Pay attention.
The rule explicitly states the retention period is 4 years. But there is absolutely no stated start date for that clock in the rule.
None. Zero.
None. The text of the rule literally just says complaints must be preserved for a period of not less than 4 years. It is the only row in the entire books and records retention table in this course that has a giant blank space for the start date.
That is so devious, because if I'm taking a multiple choice test and I see an answer that says 4 years from the receipt of the complaint, or maybe 4 years from the final resolution of the dispute, my brain is going to say, oh, that sounds incredibly logical. That must be the answer.
And you would get it completely wrong.
Wow.
Do not fall for trick answers that sound logical. Do not invent a start date on exam day just because it feels like there should be one. The answer they are looking for is just 4 years.
Just 4 years. Listener, burn that into your brain right now. 4 years. Full stop. Now, I want to clarify something else, because it feels like Sam is doing two totally different jobs here.
He is.
Yeah, we just talked about the record-keeping duty, like keeping the file accessible in the OSJ for 4 years. But doesn't Sam also have to actually, you know, read the email and deal with the problem?
Yes, and it's vital to keep those two concepts completely separate in your head.
Separate boxes.
Right. The record-keeping duty is purely about preservation and storage for the auditors.
Mm.
But there is also a supervisory duty. FINRA rules require a registered principal, which is Sam, to review incoming correspondence that reflects a customer complaint.
So job one for Sam is to read Ingrid's angry email as it comes in to supervise Riley, figure out what went wrong, and try to fix it.
Yes.
And job two is to make sure that email gets stuffed into the four-year archive for the auditors.
Precisely. Reviewing it is a supervisory function. Filing it away is a record-keeping function.
Got it.
And the exam will test these as two totally different duties. One question might ask what a firm keeps and for how long. Another question might ask who is required to review correspondence and how. Do not blend them together.
Okay, so back to our nightmare narrative. Ingrid has put her absolute fury into writing. And in this email, she doesn't just say Riley made a bad recommendation. She escalates things massively.
Oh, no. What does she do?
She alleges that Riley actually forged her signature on a discretionary trading authorization form.
Oh, wow. That is a severe escalation.
Right. It's not just a complaint anymore. It's a huge accusation. Sam, the supervisor, reads this email and his stomach immediately drops. He reaches for his giant bottle of antacids. He logs the email in the OSJ file for the four-year minimum.
As he should.
But keeping a secret file in Miami isn't enough anymore, is it? When the F word gets thrown around forgery, you can't just file it away and hope it blows over.
No, you absolutely cannot. This is where a complaint morphs into a reportable event.
So, interactive question for you, the listener. Think about the chain of command here. Riley is terrified. Sam is stressed. Whose exact job is it to report this forgery allegation to FINRA?
Think about it.
Does Riley, out of a sense of deep guilt and panic, confess directly to FINRA? Or does someone else do it?
Take a second.
Okay, what's the answer?
If you guess that Riley picks up the phone and tells FINRA himself, you fell for the trap.
It's a trick.
Yep. The direction of reporting flows strictly one way. Riley must promptly report the event to his firm. And then the firm, usually through someone like Sam or the Central Compliance Department, reports it to FINRA.
So the rep tells the firm. The firm tells the regulator.
Exactly.
If you see a test question that describes an associated person reporting an event directly to FINRA, cross it out immediately. It's a distractor.
Absolutely. FINRA's event reporting rule is built entirely on the firm acting as the central node of communication and responsibility.
Makes sense.
And there's a very strict, fast clock for this reporting. Firms have 30 calendar days to report to FINRA after the firm knows or should have known that the event exists.
30 calendar days. So the clock starts ticking the moment Sam reads that radioactive email.
Right.
But what actually triggers this 30-day clock? Is it just any complaint? Like if Ingrid emails Sam and says, Riley was incredibly rude to me on the phone, he kept interrupting me and he didn't even ask about my cats.
Not the cats.
Right. Does Sam have to report that cat-related offense to FINRA within 30 days?
No. Definitely not. The event reporting rule isn't for bad manners or poor customer service. It lists very specific severe triggers.
Like what?
It includes a written customer complaint alleging theft, misappropriation of funds or securities, or, as in our scenario, forgery. So Ingrid's email definitely triggers the 30-day clock.
What else triggers it? It can't just be forgery and theft. There has to be more.
Well, there is. It's a broad list of bad news. The 30-day clock is triggered if the firm or Riley is found to have violated securities laws by an outside regulatory body.
Okay.
It's triggered if they are indicted or convicted of a felony or certain misdemeanors. It's triggered if they are named as a defendant in a major regulatory proceeding or if they become subject to a statutory disqualification.
Wait, Back up a second. You just said found to have violated securities laws by an outside regulatory body.
I did.
Does that include FINRA? What if FINRA themselves audit the firm and they find that Riley violated a rule? Does Sam have to file a 30-day event report telling FINRA what FINRA just found?
No, and that's a brilliant nuance to highlight for the exam. FINRA's own findings and actions are explicitly excepted from this reporting rule.
Why? That seems weird.
Because it would be incredibly redundant. You do not need to report a finding by FINRA back to FINRA because FINRA already knows what FINRA did. Their own internal systems track it.
Oh, right.
You only report findings by other regulators like the SEC, a state securities administrator, or a foreign regulatory body.
Okay, that makes total sense. It's like calling your mom to tell her she just grounded you.
Exactly.
She was there. She knows. You don't need to file a report. Okay, now let's get into the weeds on something that always trips people up on exams. Numbers.
The dreaded math.
I know, but we have to do it. I want to do a side-by-side comparison of some very specific dollar thresholds. Let's say Ingrid's forgery claim goes completely sideways and she hires a lawyer and sues Riley.
Okay.
Or let's say Riley realizes he messed up terribly and before Ingrid can formally file a lawsuit, he takes her out to a Panera Bread and says, look, I'll pay you out of my own pocket right now to make this go away.
A Panera Bread settlement. Classic.
Right. What are the thresholds where these settlements or judgments become a mandatory report to FINRA?
Well, it depends entirely on who is writing the check, or more accurately, who's being named in the claim. There are two different dollar thresholds for civil litigation, arbitration, or claims for damages disposed of by judgment, award, or settlement.
Okay, what's the first one?
The first is the general threshold for associated persons like Riley. And that threshold is over $15,000.
Over $15,000. Okay, so let's get precise. If Riley settles with Ingrid out of his own pocket for exactly $15,000, is it reportable?
Technically, no.
Holy.
Yeah, the rule specifically says exceeds $15,000. If he settles for $14,999, or exactly $15,000, it does not cross the threshold. But if he settles for $15,001, boom, it is reportable.
Okay, so it has to cross the line. But what if Ingrid is really out for blood, and she doesn't just name Riley? She knows Riley doesn't have deep pockets. He's broke.
True.
So she names the entire firm. She names Sam's employer as a defendant because they failed to supervise Riley properly.
Then the bar is higher. When the member firm itself is the defendant, respondent, or subject of the claim, the amount must exceed $25,000 before the event becomes reportable under this specific rule.
Why is the firm's threshold higher? Is it literally just because they have more money?
Essentially, yes. Firms engage in thousands of transactions every day. They are often targets for nuisance suits or smaller claims simply because they have deep pockets.
Right, it's just the cost of doing business.
Exactly. And Fine and Rye recognizes this reality.
Mm-hmm.
Setting the threshold higher for the firm filters out the noise of minor everyday operational disputes while still capturing the major settlements that indicate systemic issues.
Okay, that makes sense.
But for an individual rep like Riley, a $15,000 settlement is a massive red flag that regulators want to know about immediately.
Okay, so $15,000 generally for the rep, $25,000 if it's the firm. But here is a sneaky little detail I know they love to test on.
Mm.
How do you actually calculate that $15,000 or $25,000?
Filters is a great trap.
Let's say Ingrid's actual investment loss, like the principal amount she lost on those terrible bonds, was only $12,000.
Okay.
But she had to hire a lawyer to yell at Riley, and the lawyer charged her $4,000.
This is a critical trap to avoid. Listen up. The amount you compare against the threshold includes attorney's fees and interest.
Wait, really?
Yes, it is not just the bare principle of the damages.
Wow. Okay, so Ingrid has $12,000 loss plus the $4,000 in attorney fees equals $16,000.
Exactly.
Boom! It crosses the $15,000 line for Riley, and suddenly it becomes a mandatory report to FINRA.
Exactly. You must aggregate those costs if they're part of the judgment or settlement.
Okay, let's pivot the scenario slightly. Let's say Sam, the supervisor, is incredibly proactive.
For once.
Yeah, for once. He finds out about Riley's sloppy record keeping and the potential forgery before Ingrid even complains. Sam is furious. He decides to handle it internally to nip it in the bud.
Okay, what does he do?
He calls Riley into his glass-walled office, closes the blinds, screams at him for 20 minutes, and then hands him a memo docking his next 3 commission checks as punishment.
Ouch.
Yeah. Is Sam has internal discipline of Riley reportable to FINRA?
It can be, But again, FINRA applies a dollar test to filter out minor reprimands. Mm-hmm. If Sam withholds compensation or imposes a fine on Riley, it is only reportable if that fine or withheld compensation exceeds $2,500.
Over $2,500. So if Sam docks Riley $1,000, FINRA doesn't need to know. It basically just stays between Sam and Riley?
Correct. FINRA doesn't need to be notified every single time a manager slaps a rep on the wrist.
Right.
However, there is a massive caveat here. If the internal discipline involves a suspension or a termination or any limitation on Riley's activities, there is any no dollar test. Suspensions and terminations are always reportable no matter what.
Makes perfect sense. If you take away a rep's ability to trade, even for a single day, the regulator definitely needs to know why.
Exactly.
Okay, listener, take a deep breath. Man, are you zoning out?
Stay with us.
Did the math just make your brain go a little fuzzy? Shake it off. Come back to me. Look at the road ahead or the dishes you're washing. And focus on my voice right now, because this next date is guaranteed to show up and trick you. I guarantee it.
It's a huge gotcha.
We just talked about the 30-day clock, but there is another clock hiding in the shadows. Expert, lay the trap out for them.
The trap is the quarterly statistical reporting rule.
Oh.
Yeah. We just spent all this time talking about the 30 calendar day event report, which is a floating clot. It starts whenever the firm knows or should have known about the severe event.
Right, floating.
But FANRA also requires firms to file quarterly statistical and summary information on all written customer complaints, regardless of severity. And the deadline for this is totally different.
So what is the deadline for the stats?
It is the 15th day of the month following the calendar quarter in which the firm received the complaints.
The 15th day of the month following the calendar quarter. Okay, let's compare these directly so it really clicks. Let's say Ingrid emails her forgery complaint on March 25th. The firm has 30 days from March 25th to file the specific event report because forgery is a severe trigger. That's our floating clock.
Right.
But March is also the end of the first quarter. So when does the quarterly statistical report have to include Ingrid's complaint?
Let's do the math together. The first quarter ends March 31st. The month following is April. So the quarterly statistical filing is due April 15th.
And this is the gotcha. The floating 30-day clock and the fixed April 15th calendar deadline are running simultaneously for the exact same event.
Yes, they are.
If you get a question on the exam about a forgery complaint, you have to read the question incredibly carefully. Are they asking you about the event report?
That answer is 30 days.
Right. Or are they asking about the statistical report?
That answer is the 15th of the month following the quarter.
And importantly, filing the 30-day event report does not excuse you from including it in the quarterly statistics, right?
Oh, absolutely not. They are two completely separate regulatory duties serving two different purposes.
Oh.
The event report tells FINRA, hey, we have a major emergency right now.
Like a fire alarm.
Exactly. The quarterly report tells FINRA, here is our overarching data trend for the last 3 months. You have to do both.
Amazing. Now, speaking of excusing duties, let's talk about Form U4 and Form U5. If Riley gets fired over this whole mess, Sam is going to file a Form U5 to terminate Riley's registration with the firm.
Yep. The U5 is the exit form.
And if Riley just gets disciplined and stays, Sam might update his Form U4. So can filing one of those forms excuse the firm from having to file a separate 30-day event report to FINRA? Because otherwise, Sam is just filling out the exact same information on two different forms.
Yes, FINRA does allow for exceptions to avoid duplicative reporting.
Right.
But, and this is a big, but the exceptions are not equal. This is highly testable.
Okay, let's break it down.
Let's look at the Form U4 exception first.
Yeah.
It is very narrow. It only reaches externally driven events like a regulator finding a violation or a civil litigation threshold being met. It does not reach internal discipline.
Why doesn't it reach internal discipline? If Sam docks his pay, shouldn't that be enough?
Because internal discipline isn't always fully disclosed on a standard U4 update in the same way an external lawsuit is. And crucially, to use the U4 exception, the firm must explicitly mark the disclosure on the form as satisfying the FINRA reporting duty.
Like there's a literal box to check.
There is literally a checkbox. If they don't check that box, they haven't satisfied the rule, even if all the information is typed out right there on the form.
Okay, so the U4 exception is narrow, it excludes internal discipline, and it requires a literal checkmark. What about Form U5?
The Form U5 exception is much wider. And it makes logical sense if you think about the why.
Okay, why?
Form U5 is the termination form. It is used when a person is leaving the firm or leaving the industry entirely. Because the relationship is being permanently severed, FINRA wants the absolute complete picture on that form.
It's like the final autopsy report.
Precisely. So if a firm files a U5, it excuses the separate reporting of any specified event, including internal discipline of that associated person, and it requires NO special marking.
Wow, really?
Yep. If the information is on the U5, it automatically covers the FANRAI reporting duty.
Because the rep is gone, the damage is done, the relationship is over, so FANRAI basically cuts the firm some slack on filing duplicate paperwork.
Exactly.
All right, let's summarize where we are in our nightmare scenario. Ingrid complained in writing, boom, radioactive waste. Sam put it in the OSJ file for 4 years. It alleged forgery, so Sam reported it to FANRAI within 30 days.
He did everything right.
He did. FANRAI has now read that report, and surprise, surprise, they are not happy.
Not at all. Which brings us to the next phase, the interrogation, FANRAI's investigative authority, and the brutal sanctions that come with it.
Oh, boy. So FANRAI reads Sam's report. They decide this isn't just a paperwork issue. They need to aggressively investigate Riley. Two FANRAI investigators show up at the Miami OSJ.
Suits and briefcases.
Yep. They want Riley's emails. They want his sworn testimony. They want his personal trading records. Riley is terrified. He seriously considers fleeing into the Everglades, throwing his phone in a swamp, and just completely ignoring the investigators.
A terrible plan.
A truly awful plan. What is the actual rule here? Can he just, like, plead the fifth and say, no comment?
No, he cannot plead the fifth with FANRAI. The rule is called the Information and Testimony Rule, and it is incredibly powerful.
How powerful.
It allows FANRAI's staff to require a member firm, an associated person, or literally any person subject to FANRAI's jurisdiction to provide information and to testify under oath or affirmation at a location FANRAI specifies.
Wait, they can just summon him? Like a subpoena?
Yes, they can demand this orally, in writing, or electronically, and they have the absolute right to inspect and copy the books, records, and accounts of that person with respect to any matter involved in the investigation.
Let me paint a picture to explain why fleeing into the Everglades is a terrible idea for Riley.
Please do.
Imagine Riley's records contain some highly embarrassing group chats with his college buddies. Nothing illegal, no insider trading, just incredibly cringeworthy fantasy football trash talk and bad memes.
Stuff he does not want regulators reading.
Exactly. He's mortified. He doesn't want these stiff FANRAI investigators scrolling through it, so he refuses to hand over his phone. Refusing to hand over records because you are embarrassed about a fantasy football chat is like trying to put out a small grease fire on your stove by blowing up your entire house with dynamite.
That is exactly what it's like. You have to understand the philosophy here for the exam. The entire self-regulatory system of the financial industry relies completely on cooperation.
Because they aren't cops, right?
Right. FANRAI doesn't have a police force. They don't have SWAT teams. They have auditors. If associated persons could just ignore information requests, the entire system would instantly collapse.
Makes sense.
Therefore, failing to comply with an information and testimony request is a separate, distinct violation. And it is punished far more severely than almost any underlying complaint.
So, wait, let's say the forgery complaint against Riley was actually completely baseless. Ingrid made it up entirely.
Okay.
But Riley still ignores the FANRAI request to look at his phone. He is innocent of the forgery, but guilty of ignoring FANRAI. What happens?
The exam will test you on the standard sanctions for messing with this rule. Ignoring the request is infinitely riskier than contesting the original complaint. If there is no response, or even an incomplete response, where Riley tries to hide documents, the standard sanction under FANRAI's guidelines is a bar.
A bar, with a capital B.
Capital B.
Let's do a direct comparison right now. What is the actual mechanical difference between a bar and a suspension? Because they sound somewhat similar to someone outside the industry. Like, you're not working either way.
They are drastically different in permanence. Think of a suspension as a timeout. It has a definite end date or a clear condition for return.
Like what?
Like, you are suspended for 3 months or 6 months or until you pay a specific fine. Once the condition is met, you can return to the industry.
Okay, add a bar.
A bar removes you from the industry with no defined end. It is the career death penalty. You are out, period.
So if Riley ignores the request entirely, he gets the death penalty. What if he just drags his feet? What if he's not trying to hide anything? He's just really disorganized, and he finally answers the request, but he answers it a month late.
FANRAI's sanction guidelines distinguish between ignoring and delaying. Lateness is its own category.
Oh, good to know.
If he answers late, the standard sanction is a suspension of 3 months to 2 years, along with a fine. So late is a severe timeout. Ignoring it entirely is a career ender.
Okay, so Riley realizes he can't blow up his house. He realizes he is in deep, deep trouble. The forgery allegation, the investigation, he is sweating completely through his suit. So he gets a terrible, desperate idea. the Dark Alley settlement.
I don't like the sound of this.
It's bad. Riley decides he's going to bypass Sam. He bypasses the firm's legal department entirely. He calls Ingrid, meets her in a Panera Bread, and says, Ingrid, I will give you $50,000 cash right now out of my life savings if you just call Finn on Raw and tell them you made the whole forgery thing up and you want to drop the complaint.
Wow. He's attempting to settle a customer complaint directly away from the firm.
Exactly. So here is another interactive question for you listening. Think about this closely. If Riley settles with Ingrid directly, without involving Sam or the firm, is that automatically a rule violation?
Give him a second.
Think about it. Is it automatic?
The reveal here usually surprises people. Actually, no, it is not automatic.
Wait, what? It sounds incredibly shady. It sounds literally like a bribe. How is that not an automatic violation?
It invites massive scrutiny, yes, and it is highly, highly discouraged. But the exam guidelines don't list settling away from the firm as an automatic standalone rule violation in and of itself.
That's wild.
Instead, regulators look for specific aggravating factors surrounding the settlement.
What kind of factors?
They want to know the context. Was the firm deceived? Did Riley actively hide this settlement from Sam? Did the secret settlement delay or prevent a required Form U-4 or U-5 filing? Or delay that 30-day event reporting filing we talked about?
Oh, I see.
If the firm knew about it and agreed to let him pay out of pocket, it might not be a sanctionable offense. But if he concealed it specifically to avoid a regulatory disclosure, that cover-up is what shapes the sanction.
So the crime isn't necessarily paying her off. The crime is the cover-up.
Exactly. The concealment, the obstruction of the regulatory process, is the aggravating factor that will get him suspended or fined.
Well, in our narrative, Riley doesn't manage to settle it. He doesn't have $50,000 anyway. Ingrid is out for blood. She doesn't just want a fine or a fine. She doesn't just want Riley suspended. She wants her money back for the terrible trades, plus damages for the alleged forgery.
She wants to be made whole.
Right. It's time for things to get formal. The gloves are completely off.
Which moves us into the showdown phase. Methods of formal dispute resolution.
Ingrid formally files a claim. But wait, the situation gets even messier.
Of course it does.
Riley's so stressed out by all this and so angry at Sam for not protecting him that Riley decides to sue Sam, the supervisor, for lack of support and inadequate training.
What a mess.
It's a complete circus. Everyone is suing everyone. Who goes where? We have the customer code and the industry code. How do we sort this out for the exam?
It is remarkably simple once you understand the core logic. The code is entirely dictated by WHO. The parties are, not the subject matter of the dispute.
Okay, break that down for me. Who are the fighters?
If the dispute is between a customer and a member firm, or a customer and an associated person like Riley, it goes to arbitration under the customer code.
Makes sense.
Right. Ingrid versus Riley is a customer fighting an industry professional. Therefore, customer code.
Simple enough. But what about Riley versus Sam? They're fighting over how Sam handled Ingrid's account. Doesn't that make it a customer issue?
No, it doesn't. That goes under the industry code. The industry code requires arbitration of disputes between or among members and associated persons.
Even if it's about a customer?
Yes. Even if Riley and Sam are arguing about a customer, the subject matter doesn't change the venue. It is an argument between two industry professionals, so it is strictly an industry dispute.
So who the fighters are determines the arena, not what they are fighting about.
Got it. Are there any exceptions to this mandatory arbitration? Like, do they ever get to just go to regular court?
For industry disputes, there is a specific carve-out for insurance disputes, provided the member firm is also an insurance company.
Okay, insurance is different.
Right. Those are excluded from these mandatory FI and RA arbitration rules because they usually fall under complex state insurance laws.
Got it. Okay, let's talk about time limits. Because Ingrid is meticulous with her binder, but she's also very slow to take action sometimes. Let's say this whole forgery saga actually stems from a document Riley allegedly signed 7 years ago.
7 years, okay. Yeah, Ingrid just found the document buried in her color-coded binder today. She files for arbitration today. What happens?
She runs straight into a brick wall called the six-year eligibility rule.
The six-year rule.
Yes. This rule states that a claim is barred from FANAROE arbitration once 6 years have elapsed from the event or occurrence giving rise to the claim. Since the event in your scenario was 7 years ago, Ingrid's claim is ineligible for FANAROE arbitration.
Okay. Here is the explicit exam trap. Listener, perk up.
Listen closely.
If 6 years have passed and Ingrid is kicked out of Fanner arbitration, is her claim entirely dead? Is she just out of luck and Riley gets away with it?
Absolutely not. And this is a massive misconception that people carry into the exam. The six-year rule is purely an eligibility limit for the Fanero arbitration form. It is not a statute of limitations for the law itself.
Explain the difference between those two things.
A statute of limitations legally extinguishes a claim. The Fanero eligibility rule just says, you can't use our private court system anymore. So if she is dismissed from arbitration because it's been over 6 years, that dismissal does not prohibit her from pursuing the exact same claim in regular, messy public civil court.
So Fanero is basically saying, look, this evidence is too old and stale for our fast-track arbitration system. Go take it to a real judge in a real courthouse.
Exactly.
She can still sue his pants off in state or federal court, subject to whatever the normal legal statute of limitations is in her specific jurisdiction.
Precisely. The six-year rule only closes the Fanneri arbitration door. It doesn't close the courthouse door.
Okay, let's assume her claim is only 2 years old, so it's fully eligible for arbitration. Now we have to talk about the panel sizes. When she gets to arbitration, how many arbitrators are going to sit at the table and hear her scream about Riley? You and I are going to banter on the math here because the dollar bands are very specific and highly testable.
They are very testable. The panel size rule sets the number of arbitrators entirely by the size of the claim being made. If the claim is $50,000 or less, it goes to one single arbitrator and it uses simplified procedures.
Okay, so $50K or less is one person. What if she claims $75,000?
If the claim is more than $50,000, but not more than $100,000, it is still one arbitrator, unless the parties agree in writing to have three.
So up to 100K is generally one arbitrator by default. What if she is swinging for the fences? What if the claim is $250,000? Or what if she doesn't specify a dollar amount at all and just demands punitive justice?
Claims for more than $100,000 or unspecified claims where no dollar amount is listed default to a panel of three arbitrators, unless all parties agree in writing to use just one.
Okay, here is the exam trap on the math. Let's say Ingrid's core claim is $49,000. She lost exactly $49,000 on those bad bonds, but she also wants $2,000 in interest because she's been waiting 2 years, and maybe $500 for filing fees.
Okay, doing the math.
$49,000 plus $2,500 is $51,500. Does she get bumped up out of the simplified one arbitrator procedures into the next tier?
No, and you must remember this on exam day. The dollar bands for determining panel size exclude the interest and expenses. You only look at the core claim amount.
Why? I mean, money is money, right?
Because interest accrues over time. If they included interest, a claim could bump into a different panel size just because the arbitration hearing was delayed by a month.
Oh, that makes sense.
Right. FOINRA wants a stable number based on the actual alleged damages. A $49,000 claim with $2,000 in interest is still evaluated as a $49,000 claim. It stays in the lowest band. One arbitrator.
Don't let the interest trick you. Strip out the interest, strip out the expenses, then look at the number.
Okay, I want to do a direct comparison of the three forms of dispute resolution: arbitration, mediation, and litigation. We know arbitration is generally required by the rules. It's final, it's binding, and there are basically no appeals.
Right.
What about mediation? Could Riley try to mediate this with Ingrid first to avoid the harshness of arbitration?
He could if she agrees. Mediation is totally voluntary. It requires the written agreement of all parties. You sit down with a neutral mediator who tries to help you reach a compromise.
Is it binding? Unlike an arbitration award, a mediation is entirely non-binding. The mediator cannot force either party to do anything. It only becomes binding if and when a formal settlement agreement is signed by both parties at the very end of the process.
Okay, push back here, because this is a mechanical question they love to ask. If they agree to mediate, does the mediation automatically hit the pause button on the arbitration clock?
Emphatically, no.
Like, if they are scheduled for a binding arbitration hearing next month but decide to try mediation today, does the arbitration hearing get postponed?
Submitting a matter to mediation does not stay or delay a pending arbitration.
Not at all. Not even a little.
Not unless all parties agree in writing to stay the arbitration. If they don't explicitly agree to pause it, the arbitration train keeps rolling down the tracks at full speed while they're sitting in the dining car trying to mediate.
The train keeps rolling. I love that visual. You have to physically hit the brakes together in writing or you're still heading for an arbitration award. And then the third forum is litigation going to a real court with a judge and a jury. And as we established, that's generally only available if arbitration isn't required or if the claim aged out under the six-year eligibility rule.
Correct.
So back to our narrative. They go to arbitration. A panel of three arbitrators sits there. They listen to Ingrid. They look at Riley's terrible paperwork and the alleged forged signatures, and they rule in Ingrid's favor. Riley lost.
He is crushed.
He is fined, he is suspended, and he is disgraced. Now he has to carry the scarlet letter for the rest of his career. Which brings us to the final act of this nightmare, the permanent record and Form U4.
This is where Sam, the supervisor, comes back into the picture with a very heavy sigh, because Sam has to update Riley's Form U4 to reflect this disaster. Form U4 is the central registration depository form. It's Riley's permanent public resume in the financial industry.
And there are strict clocks for updating it. We talked earlier about a 30-day clock for reporting an event to FFNRO. What is the clock for filing a general amendment to a U4?
It's also 30 days. The firm must file an amendment to the U4 no later than 30 days after learning of the facts or circumstances giving rise to the amendment.
Okay, so Riley gets the arbitration award against him. Sam has 30 days to update the U4. But wait. If Riley did something truly horrific, let's say the forgery was so bad it actually resulted in a felony criminal conviction, there is a faster clock for the really bad stuff, right?
Yes. If the amendment involves a statutory disqualification, the firm must file it no later than 10 days after the disqualification occurs.
Okay, let's pause. We need to define statutory disqualification because that is heavy industry jargon. What actually is it?
A statutory disqualification means a person has committed an act so severe that they are legally disqualified from associating with any FIMRI member firm in any capacity.
So they're totally out.
It is the ultimate exile. It includes things like being convicted of any felony within the last 10 years or certain misdemeanors involving money or securities. It includes being expelled from another self-regulatory organization or having an SEC order revoking your registration.
So it's not just a rule violation, it's a fundamental breach of trust that makes you an actual danger to the public.
Exactly. And because that person is now an immediate danger to the public, the regulator does not want them lingering in the industry for a month while the firm does paperwork. That is why the clock shrinks from 30 days down to 10 days.
Okay, listener, here is the trap. The exam will try to make you think the 10-day clock applies to any severe complaint or any massive arbitration award.
Oh.
It doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
Let's say Ingrid wins a $10 million arbitration award against Riley. Does Sam have to update the U4 in 10 days?
No. Even a $10 million award is just a civil judgment. It is not a statutory disqualification. The update is still 30 days.
The 10-day clock is strictly, exclusively for statutory disqualifications. Do not use the 10-day clock unless it is the absolute nuclear option.
Good advice.
Now, there is something else inside the Form U4 that we really need to deep dive into because it ties this whole episode together. It's the U4 arbitration disclosure.
Yes. We talked about how disputes go to arbitration. But why? They go there because when Riley originally signed his Form U4 to join the industry on day one, he agreed to an arbitration clause that sits inside the form itself.
He signed his rights away.
He contractually committed to arbitrate disputes with his firm, his customers, or other associated persons.
And the firm has to give him a disclosure about this before he signs it, right? Let me give you an analogy for how this feels. Signing the U4 arbitration clause is like blindly clicking agree on an iTunes terms of service update.
We all do it.
We all do it. Nobody reads it. But imagine if, instead of just promising Apple you won't use iTunes to build a nuclear weapon, which is actually, in their terms, look it up, you are promising to never ever sue your boss in front of a jury of your peers. That is a massive right to sign away.
It is a profound waiver of constitutional rights, specifically the right to a trial by jury in a public courtroom. That is why the Form U4 arbitration disclosure rule exists.
To make sure they know.
Right. The regulator says, if you are going to force employees to sign away their right to a jury, you must give them a written disclosure detailing exactly what they're giving up before they sign the U4.
I want to do a direct comparison here because the exam loves to test similarities. This employee disclosure sounds exactly like the pre-dispute arbitration agreement that customers like Ingrid sign when they open a brokerage account. Are they the exact same thing?
Do not confuse them. They are entirely different disclosures tailored for entirely different audiences.
How are they different?
The customer-facing pre-dispute arbitration agreement, which goes in a new account form, has 7 specific bullet points. The Form U4 agreement, which goes to the associated person like Riley, has 9 numbered items.
Customers get 7 points, reps get 9 points. Memorize that difference. What do those 9 points actually tell Riley?
They describe the harsh realities of how arbitration differs from court. They warn Riley that the process of getting documents from the other side is much more limited than in a real court. They warn him that the panel might include industry-affiliated arbitrators. They warn him that awards are generally final and binding, and the ability to appeal to a real judge is extremely limited.
Wait, do the arbitrators have to explain why they ruled the way they did? Like, if they order Riley to pay $50,000, do they write a 50-page legal opinion justifying the math?
Usually, no. And that's another of the 9 disclosure points. Arbitrators do not need to explain the reasoning behind their awards.
That sounds infuriating. Is there any way to force them to explain it?
There's only one exception. If all parties jointly request an explained decision at least 20 days before the first scheduled hearing date.
All parties must request it, and they have to do it 20 days before the hearing. So if Riley just asks for it by himself because he wants to know why he lost, he doesn't get it.
Correct. Both Riley and Ingrid would have to agree they want an explanation.
Okay, so Riley gave up his right to sue Sam in court for almost everything. But are there any carve-outs? Are there any situations where Riley can take his firm or his boss to a real court with a real judge? Like, if Sam physically assaults him, Fanra can't honestly say that has to go to a secret arbitration panel, right?
You are correct. There are 3 specific carve-outs from the Form U4 arbitration clause, meaning these 3 types of claims are not automatically forced into arbitration just because Riley signed the U4.
What are the 3?
Number 1, statutory employment discrimination claims. Number 2, claims under a whistleblower statute. Number 3, sexual assault or sexual harassment claims.
Okay, interactive question for the listener. Pay close attention because the mechanics of how these carve-outs work are different, and test writers love mechanical differences. How is a sexual assault carve-out mechanically different from the employment discrimination and whistleblower carve-out?
Give them a beat.
Think about it.
The reveal here is about timing and power. For statutory employment discrimination and whistleblower claims, they simply cannot be arbitrated under the U4. They go to court by default, unless the parties make a totally separate new agreement to arbitrate them after the dispute arises.
Okay, so discrimination defaults to court. How does sexual harassment work?
The sexual assault and sexual harassment carve-out works differently.
Yeah.
Because of recent federal law changes, these claims start as arbitrable under the agreement. But the claiming party gets a special unilateral power to opt out after the dispute arises.
Oh, I see. So if Riley had a discrimination claim, he goes straight to court. If he has a sexual harassment claim, it might default to the arbitration track, but he holds a trump card. After the bad thing happens, he can slam that card on the table and say, nope, I'm opting out. I'm taking this to a public jury.
Exactly. The claimant holds the power to opt out after the fact. It is a very specific mechanical difference from the other 2 carve-outs, and it is highly testable.
Wow. We have covered an incredible amount of ground. We've gone from a screaming phone call about a bad bond to a radioactive email to a 30-day reporting panic to a massive arbitration and finally to a permanent black mark on a form U4.
A full journey.
It really is. Let's do a rapid-fire recap of the top testable takeaways from this entire unit. I want to speed run this for you so it is locked in your brain.
Let's lock it in.
Number 1, complaints. They must be written. Oral complaints, screaming on the phone, do not trigger the record-keeping rule. You keep the written file for 4 years, and there is no stated start date for that clock. It lives at the OSJ or must be instantly accessible there.
Number 2, reporting thresholds. The event clock is 30 calendar days from when the firm knows. The civil settlement thresholds are $15,000 for reps and $25,000 for the firm. And remember, that includes attorney fees and interest. Internal discipline is only reportable if the fine or withheld pay is over $2,500, but suspensions are always reportable.
Number 3, Fanra interrogations. Ignore Fanra's request for info. You get a bar the career death penalty. Answer late. You get a suspension of timeout.
Number 4, arbitration. The 6-year eligibility limit bars a claim from Fanra arbitration, but not from civil court. Panel sizes are 1 arbitrator up to $100 and 3 arbitrators over $100K. And remember, those dollar bands exclude interest and expenses. Number 5, Form U4. The general amendment clock is 30 days. The statutory disqualification clock is 10 days. The U4 arbitration disclosure has 9 items, not 7 like the customer agreement. And remember the sexual assault opt-out mechanic. That covers the core mechanics. But I want to leave you with a final provocative thought to chew on as you study this material.
It's here.
We've spent this time looking at how FINRA rules strictly funnel almost all disputes into arbitration. They severely limit discovery, they keep their records out of the public eye, they don't require explained decisions, and they basically eliminate appeals. It begs the question, who is really benefiting more from this closed ecosystem? Is it the investor, like Ingrid, getting swifter, cheaper justice without paying massive court fees? Or is it the financial industry, shielding its dirty laundry and its mistakes from the public eye of a courtroom jury? Think about that tension, that balance of power, as you memorize these rules.
It's a closed loop, and now you know exactly how it works. You have the tools, you have the traps, and you know the gotchas. Go crush this exam. Thanks for taking the deep dive with us.